Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. It was on this very day, back in which year, that Billboard magazine published its very first listing of best-selling singles. Was that A, 1940, B, 1950, C, 1960, or D, 1970? Hint, that first listing by Billboard only had 10 songs on the list, and the number one single that year, that issue, was I'll Never Smile Again, sung by Frank Sinatra with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. So which year was that? 1940, 50, 60, or 70? And question number two. And it was on this very day back in which year that Duke Ellington and his band performed a 10-minute composition on ABC TV titled Moon Maiden. Hint. The song was in honor of Neil Armstrong's lunar landing the day before. So in which year was that televised 10-minute Duke Ellington performance? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and classicbands.com. And today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of July the 19th. Well, it was on this very day, back in 1966, that 51-year-old Frank Sinatra married 21-year-old actress Mia Farrow. It was her first marriage and his third. 2 years later, while Farrell was filming Roman Polanski's Rosemary's Baby, Sinatra sent his lawyer to the movie set to inform his wife that he was filing for divorce. And it was 39 years ago today, 1980, that Billy Joel earned his first gold record with It's Still Rock and Roll to Me. 1980 today. And in country and folk music news, we have this article entitled, New Dawn. Mountain Man's Alexandra Sauser-Monig embarks on a solo adventure as Daughter of Swords. This is written by Ryan Jarrell and published in Indie Week on the 10th of July, 2019. The harmonizing folk trio Mountain Man, that's Amelia Meath, Molly Sarley, and Alexandra Sauser-Monig spun songs they made up on the front porch of their house near Bennington College into national success, going on to support some indie icons as Feist and the Decemberists, and releasing their second album, Magic Skip, on the distinguished label Nonesuch Records last year. Once again, that's Magic Ship. In the 8 years between the first and second Mountain Man albums, Sauser-Monig graduated from college and decided to explore other ways of being human on planet Earth. She moved to North Carolina and worked at goat dairies and flower farms, spent some time in Asheville living with people who were starting a weaving business, and then moved to the Triangle to work at a library, pouring all that nature and thinking time into Dawn Breaker, her debut solo album as Daughter of Swords. Released by Nonesuch, Dawn Breaker is a sleek 10-song collection. It has the affable minimalist glow that fans associate with Mountain Man, paired with Seltzer Monig's particularly deep lyrics and impressive vocalism, representing a chapter in local folk music that isn't afraid of the occasional electronic flourish. We caught up with Seltzer Monig to discuss her solo writing process, the ups and downs of names, and how North Carolina influenced this batch of songs. How did living in the area inflect your writing process? Longleaf Pines is a really great example. I wrote that song right when I moved to North Carolina and was trying to understand the climate and the plants and the air and the sunshine. North Carolina is overflowing with life constantly because it's so damned hot. There's more bugs than anywhere else I've ever lived, and I feel like that roly-poly waterfall of greenery and life and humidity is a part of the feeling of the record. And Nick Sanborn and I were pretty intentional about capturing room sound, and the room had very thin walls. There are things you can hear from outside on the record. I think that process was receptive to the life of the place it was recorded in. Can you tell me more about your songwriting process? I am a fiend for melody. Songwriting can look a lot different ways. The most magical is when you have a feeling that you might write a song and it comes out quickly, lyrics and melody pretty fully formed. Other times, it's like you'll sing a fragment of a line or melodic idea and then really have to work at it, and I feel like it can unfold in funny ways when you'll come up with the chorus and then try to write the verses and have to throw them out several times. The shifting of focus whenever you run into a brick wall trying to come at it from a different angle can help me break through, which is true for a lot of things people do in life. And in classical music news, we have this article entitled, At Home and Abroad. As the universities bring in the best of New York and Europe, our homegrown classical music scene shines. This is written by Dan Ruscia, published in Indie Week on the 10th of July, 2019. Classical music is a tricky thing. Over the past century, its overriding sense of elitism, the notion that the only way to experience it is in a perfect performance by a major performer, has created a situation where the relative merits of a classical scene are often defined more by who is coming to town rather than who is from town. We are lucky that the Triangle does well on both fronts, from the world-class imports of the university presenters to the homegrown populism of the Raleigh Civic Symphony and Chamber Orchestra. The out-of-town landscape continues to be dominated by Duke performances and Carolina Performing Arts. While it's important to get a glimpse of what's shaking things up in New York and London, Los Angeles and Berlin, the true engine of the scene is local. We have numerous ensembles covering different corners of classical music. North Carolina Opera presents fully staged classic operas. Duke's Chompy Quartet continues to find new things to say in the string quartet repertory. The centerpiece of the local classical scene remains the North Carolina Symphony. In recent decades, it has built a reputation for strong performances of orchestral staples alongside a fascinating commissioning program focusing on works by a younger generation of composers, often with North Carolina connections. The article skips down. One local organization that has no problem for grounding a diverse range of voices is the Raleigh Civic Symphony and Chamber Orchestra. The symphony has been around since the 1970s, and the Chamber Orchestra was founded in 2000. In the last 5 years, the orchestra has presented some of the most fascinating and inventive programs in the area. Unlike the North Carolina Symphony or the Chamber Orchestra of the Triangle, the Civic's musicians are almost entirely amateurs. An equal mix of NC State students, the university is a co-sponsor of the group, and community members. Each concert has its own theme based on historical events or created with NC State faculty. Even more impressive, the Raleigh Civic Symphony has presented a world premiere in every concert in the past 4 years. 16 new pieces so far. While professional orchestras will commission a few pieces a year, that concentration is really unusual, especially for an amateur ensemble. Article skips down and ends with this. Everybody says that they're scared of programming new music, but the new piece is always the piece that people come away talking about. Why should it only be the elite groups that play new music? Normal people, community people, should have that experience of bringing a new piece to life. It shouldn't be reserved for people in New York and L.A. and people who want to conservatory. And in jazz and blues music news, we have this article entitled, In a Sentimental Mood. The Museum of Durham History highlights the city's storied place in pre-war jazz. This is written by Lucas Hubbard, published in Indie Week on the 10th of July, 2019. Research theory. Research any historical figure long enough, and eventually you'll find your way back to Durham Tobacco. Take Duke Ellington. The jazz great has many connections to the area, most notably through his longtime collaborator, Billy Strayhorn, who spent much of his childhood in Hillsboro. But Ellington's first tie to Triangle lore was knotted in 1935 when he performed in Durham that March. The legend goes that Ellington composed his standard, In a Sentimental Mood, to ease tensions at the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company party. Laura Windley, curator of Durham's early jazz and swing, the new community exhibit at the Museum of Durham History, combed through archival material to compile an overview of the city's role in the swing era. That year, she found that Ellington was only in town to play at Roycroft Warehouse at the Mutual After Party. He wrote the standard on the spot. It's not crazy to think, then, that the song of choice for 9 different radio shows and infinite first dances might never have existed without an initial show at that tobacco auction place on Rigsby Avenue. Everyone talks about, oh, the Durham Armories where all the big bands played, says Winsley. With the aid of peers in the swing dance community, she aimed to answer the follow-up question, well, who played there? It's an extensive list from the Count Basie Orchestra to Ella Fitzgerald to Andy Kirk and his Clouds of Joy, featuring pianist and future Duke jazz professor Mary Lou Williams. The exhibit, which runs through July, touches on Durham's contributions to the Piedmont blues scene in the mid-1920s, the development of jazz, as Duke, as well as the city's place on the national circuit during the big band heyday. The exhibit doesn't explore beyond World War II, but to make a long story short, while much has changed in nearly 80 years, jazz is still very much alive here. Glenn Miller isn't around to serenade Duke as he did in 1940, though the orchestra bearing his name visits my Mandy Concert Hall on July the 15th. Article skips down, ends with this. But the biggest buzz simply surrounds the revival of swing music in the place where so many greats have played. People are excited to have this knowledge, says Winley, and I think it did the job of getting people excited about dancing at the Durham Armory again. And in music research and technology, we have this article published in the New York Times on the 11th of July, 2019, by Emily S. Rube. It's entitled, New Medical Alarms Aim to Reduce Hospital Noise. In 2012, Yoko Sen was in an emergency room, tethered to a machine, bleeding relentlessly in her ear. She was freaked out, she said, and felt helpless. When a nurse returned to the room, Sen asked if it was okay. The device was screaming. Yeah, this thing just beeps, she recalled the nurse saying. Sen, an electronic musician, was stunned. How could something so loud and so jarring be considered normal? The fear of not knowing amplified the feeling of anxiety, she said. And how, she wondered, could clinicians withstand the clangor? Hospitals today can be sonic hellscapes, which studies have shown regularly exceed levels set by the World Health Organization. Droning IV pumps, ding-donging nurse call buttons, voices crackling on loudspeakers, ringing telephones, beeping elevators, buzzing ID scanners, clattering carts, coughing, screaming, vomiting. Then there are the alarms. A single patient might trigger hundreds each day, challenging caregivers to figure out which machine is beeping and what is wrong with the patient, if anything. Studies have shown that as many as 99% of alarms are false. The proliferation of pinging and bleeping can contribute to patient delirium and staff burnout. And because caregivers know that many devices are crying wolf, they might be less responsive or apathetic, a potentially fatal safety issue known as alarm fatigue. From 2005 to 2008, more than 500 patients in the United States had adverse outcomes, mostly death, because an alarm was ignored or a device was silenced or mismanaged in some way, according to the Food and Drug Administration, which tracks adverse events involving medical devices. Absence of care. You don't need to have alarms scream at you, said Judy Edworthy, a professor of applied psychology. For device manufacturers, sound is often an afterthought in the design, Edworthy said, and they are worried about being sued if a machine had failed to cry out. So without an enforcement or enforceable universal standard, alarms have run riot. They are also using sounds based on an outdated set of international safety standards, which have, paradoxically, perpetuated the din. Together, this group is developing tones that replace the blare of the current alarms with signals that mimic electronic dance music or a heartbeat. They are working to make alarms quieter, combining audible alarms with visual cues like interactive screens that look like paintings, and working to develop a new standard that is likely to go into effect early next year. Unnecessary noise is the cruelest absence of care, Sen said to a room full of medical professionals at a conference last year about end-of-life management. The words came from the mother of modern nursing, Florence Nightingale, who worked in the Crimean War in the 19th century. Audio technology has changed drastically since the standard 8 tones were created, said Edworthy. It's now possible to produce pretty much any sound you want from a medical device, she said. Of course, that's a whole new set of problems. The proposed sounds, called auditory icons, are representative of their functions, like the crumpling paper sound that your computer makes when you throw files in the trash. In this case, the sounds represent critical organ functions and imitate the lub-dub sound of a heartbeat, or a rattling pill bottle for a drug infusion, or a whistling teacup for temperature. We've amassed a load of data demonstrating that these sounds work very well, said Edworthy. Article skips down and ends with this. Edworthy said she was confident that the new sounds would be adopted, providing politics don't get in the way. Yoko Sen has since recovered from her illness, but the bleeding monitors are still the soundtrack of my life, she said. Through her startup, Sen Sound, based in Washington, she has collaborated with medical device engineers to create new tones for home heart monitors and with interior designers to build a so-called tranquility room where clinicians can relax, making them less likely to slam doors or talk loudly. And in rock and pop music news, The Beatles' All You Need Is Love introduces this movie review. Name of the movie? Yesterday. A world without the Fab Four? Don't let it be. This is a comedy drama film. After a brief global blackout, the world seems pretty much the same. One might say that, obladi oblada, life goes on. But it doesn't. Somehow history has been rewritten, or at least rescored, and the Beatles have been completely erased from human consciousness. The same goes for Oasis, but that's a smaller matter. There's no Lennon and McCartney catalog, no Hey Jude, Can't Buy Me Love, Penny Lane, or even the continuing story of Bungalow Bill. But within this catastrophic fluke, there's a potentially redeeming flunkette. A struggling British musician named Jack Malik, Himesh Patel, remembers the songs. When he performs them, enthralled listeners hail him as the greatest pop phenomena since, you know. Danny Boyle, Slumdog Millionaire, directs this musical fairy tale with unclouded simplicity and charm, although the script, by Love Actually's Richard Curtis, doesn't know when to rein in the sentimentality. One big twist late in the story will have you either sobbing or rolling your eyes. There's a thin line between yeah, yeah, yeah and yada, yada, yada. So this is released on June the 28th. It's rated as PG-13. A former regular on the BBC soap EastEnders, UK native Himesh Patel, 28, says getting to sing Beatles classics at Wembley Stadium for the film was incredible. He hasn't met Paul McCartney or Ringo Starr, but I hope someone warns me before I do. It's one of those where you are so nervous you don't say anything. You just drool. Once again, this was written by Kara Warner, published in People Magazine, July the 8th, 2019. The Embers' I Love Beach Music introduces our local music news. Summerfest 2019 North Carolina Symphony. Booth Amphitheater in Cary. Annual Beach Party starring the Embers. That's coming up Saturday, July 20th, 2019 at 7:30 p.m. Go to ncsymphony.org or phone 919-733-2750. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this very day, back in which year, that Billboard magazine published its very first listing of best-selling singles. Was that A, 1940, B, 1950, C, 1960, or D, 1970? And I gave as a hint that the first listing by Billboard only had 10 songs on the list, and the number one single was I'll Never Smile Again, sung by Frank Sinatra with the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra. Correct answer, therefore, answer A, 1940. As noted in songfacts.com, this song was written by a Toronto-based songwriter named Ruth Lowe, who composed it out of the despair she felt when her husband, Harold Cohen, died in 1939. Cohen was a Canadian fighter pilot who was killed in action. Lowe's sentiment was that she could never really find another love or even laugh again since her true love was killed. To give the song a more universal appeal, she made it about a breakup, including the lines, "Tears would fill my eyes, my heart would realize that our romance is through." And the answer to our second question, it was on this very day, back in which year, that Duke Ellington and his band performed a 10-minute composition on ABC TV titled Moon Maiden. And as a hint, I mentioned that the song was in honor of Neil Armstrong's lunar landing the day before. So in which year was that televised 10-minute Duke Ellington performance? Well, it was, of course, 1969. Duke Ellington, one of America's greatest composers and jazz musicians, was commissioned by ABC TV to compose and perform a 10-minute vocal feature that honored the nation and also the moon landing. So it was part of ABC's 30 hours of continuous coverage of that first moon landing. And it was written for piano, bass, and drums, but it also marked Ellington's public debut as a vocalist. We close out, therefore, as we came in, with Duke Ellington, along with John Coltrane, performing Angelica. While we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review, and as we leave you, remember these words, kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program, intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have a suggestion, give me a call, 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.